This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Israeli forces conduct another deadly raid on the Jenin refugee camp. In the occupied West Bank, shooting a young Palestinian in the head. Russia's tough response to the West's sanctions over the Ukraine war. Gazprom halts gas supplies to Bulgaria and Poland. And also ahead, China blasts the passage of a U.S. warship through the Taiwan Strait, saying the move deliberately harms peace and stability. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: the Israeli regime intensifying its crackdown across the occupied West Bank ahead of International Quds Day. The latest round of violence happened at the Jenin refugee camp hours ago, where a young Palestinian was shot in the head and three others sustained injuries. Since March, Israel has escalated its violent raids across the occupied territories, prompting retaliatory Palestinian operations. The Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds has been a flashpoint, with Israeli forces brutally attacking Palestinian worshippers during the holy month of Ramadan. Happening early this morning in Syria, four Syrian soldiers have been killed in an Israeli air raid targeting positions in the vicinity of the capital, Damascus. The defense ministry says three more soldiers have been wounded. According to local media, Syrian air defense has intercepted most of the missiles over Damascus. Israel frequently targets areas inside Syria with airstrikes. The attacks mainly target military sites as well as the positions of resistance fighters battling terrorist groups. Iran has hosted an international conference in solidarity with Palestinians. The event also seeks to find ways to bring the ongoing Israeli attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque to a halt. Yusuf Jalali report.
Quds, the axis of Muslims' unity. This is the theme of this international conference that drew political figures and activists from across the world to Tehran to express their solidarity with Palestinians in their struggle against Israel's occupation.
The message of the conference here is for expressing unity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters who are suffering and who are struggling for their independence and their sovereignty.
The centrality of the issue of Palestine for the Muslim world is what we want to remind some of the Arab states that ignored this fact and contemptibly normalized their ties with the criminal regime of Israel despite the will of their nations. Some Arab leaders must be ashamed even more now when we see that the Israelis are attacking Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Israeli forces have repeatedly attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound site since early April, with the onset of the holy month of Ramadan, which coincided with Jewish Passover. Last week, more than 150 Palestinian worshippers were injured when Israeli forces stormed the compound in the occupied city of Al-Quds. The regime has pressed ahead with its violence in the Flashpoint site and has been cracking down on solidarity protests throughout the occupied West Bank.
What is happening today in Palestine has been repeated for the last 72 years. Added to that, that today the crimes of Israel has exceeded all the human rights and all war crimes. UNESCO itself has declared that Al-Aqsa Mosque is an Islamic sanctity, is an Islamic place. It has nothing related to the Jewish religion. What is the relevance to the extreme Zionist Jewish settlers to get into the mosque and pray over there? There is no relation to them over there. What we want today is that the international community has to understand that Israel has violated the freedom of worshipping rights.
This conference is held ahead of the International Quds Day, a global pro-Palestine rally that takes place every year on the last Friday of the month of Ramadan. Activists here regard Quds Day as an opportunity to shed light on the Israeli crimes in Palestine and hope that it would instigate the international community to take action in support of Palestinians.
Delegates here say Palestine remains the top priority and the innermost issue of the Muslim world, calling on Muslims worldwide to participate in the International Quds Day en masse. They say this is the only way to bring the Palestinian cause to light amid attempts by Tel Aviv to sweep its crimes under the rug. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Russia raising tensions over an energy dispute with the West to a higher level by cutting off natural gas supplies to Bulgaria and Poland. Giant energy corporation Gazprom says it has completely halted gas deliveries to the two countries because they've been refusing to make payments in Russian currency. According to a statement by Gazprom, supplies will not resume until Sofia and Warsaw abide by the new terms. Last month, President Vladimir Putin announced that those countries, which are unfriendly to Russia, will have to pay for their gas in rubles. Putin warned that those countries would risk losing Russian gas supplies if they fail to comply with the currency switch. And Russia has agreed to allow the United Nations and the Red Cross to help evacuate civilians from a besieged steel plant in the city of Mariupol. Russia says Ukraine should take responsibility for the people holed up in the steel facility. A number of Ukrainian soldiers are hunkered down in the plant. Kiev says there are also hundreds of civilians. Moscow blames the Ukrainian government for continued failure of humanitarian corridors for the evacuation of civilians. Russia declared victory in Mariupol last week, and it continues fighting in eastern and southern Ukraine. Moscow says its forces have now liberated the entire Kherson region in southern Ukraine, as well as several other regions. Meantime, the U.S. and its allies have pledged to provide large amounts of weaponry to Ukraine. Russia has warned of a real danger of a third world war if the West keeps arming Ukraine. Russia's military offensive in Ukraine has taken a new casualty: Moscow's ties with Tel Aviv. Israel, which had volunteered for mediating between Ukraine and Russia when the war was started, appears to be taking sides now, and Moscow is warning Tel Aviv of the consequences of such partiality.
The Israeli-Russian ties have been deteriorating rapidly over the past few weeks. Most recently, Russia's ambassador to Israel, Anatoly Viktorov, has warned that Moscow will introduce retaliatory measures against Israel in case the Tel Aviv regime supplies Ukraine with military equipment and aid amid the military conflict there. Viktorov issued the warning in a televised interview on Thursday. It was not immediately clear from the Russian envoy's remarks what such a response might entail.
And I think that we'll see strengthening of cooperation and increased military support for Syria and other regional partners of Russia in the region if Israel goes along with supporting Ukraine. And it's important to note that Ukraine has said that it wants to be in Israel. It wants to be Israel in Europe. It doesn't want to be absolutely liberal and European.
The comments came a day after the Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Israel will provide Ukraine with helmets and flak jackets. Last week, the Russian Foreign Ministry summoned Israeli ambassador to Moscow after Tel Aviv denounced Russia's military operation in Ukraine. It came after the Israeli Foreign Minister accused Russia of committing war crimes in Ukraine, alleging that there was no justification for Russia's military campaign against its Western neighbor. Earlier this month, the Israeli regime voted in favor of a United Nations General Assembly resolution suspending the Russian Federation's membership in the UN Human Rights Council. The move was made over claims of gross and systematic violations and abuses of human rights in Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Ministry called the resolution, quote, unlawful and politically motivated.
Russia says Israel is taking advantage of the situation surrounding Ukraine to divert public attention from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, one of the world's oldest unresolved disputes. That has become especially clear due to the heavy-handed tactics that Israel has recently used against Palestinians while desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque. Many observers believe it indeed is ironic to hear the accusation of war crimes from Israeli officials who are widely blamed for crimes against the people of Palestine.
Taking a sideswipe at Israel and the United States, the Russian Foreign Ministry has said that the longest occupation in the post-war history is being carried out by Israel with the tacit approval of the West. The ministry further bashed the blockade of the besieged Gaza Strip, which Israel says is needed to prevent arms from reaching the Palestinian resistance movements in the enclave.
Well, one of the things that it's important is that Israel saying that Russia has committed war crimes is laughable, since Israel itself has been liable and the charges are severe to their war crimes and human rights violations against the Palestinian people, most recently in the war on the people of Gaza just last year in 2021.
Ukraine has asked Israel for weapons and equipment, including the Iron Dome missile system, something that Tel Aviv hasn't publicly approved so far. Russia has said that foreign weapons sent to Ukraine will be fair game for its military attacks. If Israel decides to sell arms to Russia's Western neighbor, will there be a conflict between the two?
So I think it's not yet sure what's happening, but I think what we are seeing is a shift of Israel from being neutral in this current special military operation to openly supporting Ukraine. So it might shift, but it will cost them. It'll cost them heavily because Russia is an important player in Israel-Palestine.
Since Russian President Vladimir Putin announced a special military operation in Ukraine on February 24 and officially recognized the breakaway regions of Luhansk and Donetsk as two republics, the political lines across the globe have been getting redrawn. As Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned, that risks the situation spiraling into a third world war.
The passage of a U.S. warship through the sensitive Taiwan Strait is drawing protests from China, which is calling the move provocative. According to a statement by the Chinese military, the U.S. actions not only deliberately harm peace and stability in the waterway, but they also send wrong signals to Taiwan forces seeking independence. In response, the U.S. Navy has said that the warship only conducted a routine transit that is allowed under international law. China considers the island as its territory and views such U.S. activities as a sign of support for Taiwan. Washington has no diplomatic relations with Taiwan, but is the island's most important international supporter and arms supplier. An informed source close to Iran's negotiating team tells Press TV that certain media reports about an imminent revival of the 2015 deal are false. The source was referring to a recent report by some Saudi media. The report suggested the foreign ministers of the parties to the deal will meet in Vienna soon to announce the final agreement of the revival of the JCPOA. The source said such a meeting has been expected since a few months ago, but no specific time has been set for it. The source said such a meeting will not convene unless the U.S. accepts Iran's red lines. Washington has been under tremendous pressure from its European allies to accept Tehran's conditions and give the necessary guarantees to Iran. Scott Bennett is a former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer. He told us such reports are published in the hope that Donald Trump would return to the White House.
Well, they are being seen as the warmongering Yemen genocide functionaries that the Trump administration were enabling to continue the war against Yemen. The Trump administration was enabling the Israelis to make war against Syria through all sorts of policy choices that I thought were very bad choices, and as well as the assassination of Soleimani and all sorts of other things. So Saudi Arabia and Israel are in a desperate position to try and keep hope alive that Trump is going to return and that Biden is going to disintegrate. And they're weakening him for that very purpose. So Iran's best tactic is to demonstrate in all of the chaos and the confusion and the smoke of war and the clamorings of insults that have been hurled between Russia, Ukraine, and all of these European countries that are desperately nervous, Iran can introduce itself as a voice of stability, as a peacemaker, as a peacekeeper, as the new power that is rising up out of Asian landmass to balance out the problems that Saudi Arabia has been developing in Yemen.
Iran's ambassador to the UN says in order to resolve the crisis in Syria, occupation must end and terror threats eradicated. According to Majid Takht Ravachi, Syria needs more humanitarian aid now than at any time since the war began a decade ago. He noted that the current economic downturn has affected people's lives and that it's vital to lift the unilateral sanctions on Syria to improve the dire humanitarian situation. The Iranian diplomat underlined that such illegal measures run counter to UN resolutions. He also called for an end to the looting of Syria's natural resources, especially oil, by foreign states. Takht Ravachi said the only solution to the Syria crisis is a political process led by Damascus and facilitated by the UN. And the dust has settled after France's election, and many say the nation isn't looking too well. A lackluster election has revealed extreme divisions, which President Emmanuel Macron may only worsen. Rami Mazuri has more from Paris.
With the re-election of President Emmanuel Macron, France's mainstream media has stopped worrying about fascism and started to honestly discuss the state of the country. A France divided is the most common headline. In 2017, Macron promised to not give France a reason to vote for the extremes of the political spectrum, but the far right and the far left have both grown to new highs.
It's a good thing Macron was re-elected. We need a young, efficient, pro-European president with a long-term vision. I'm surprised at the high score for the National Front, but in their economic program, they forget that it's the bosses who are in charge of salaries and not the president.
Le Pen won just 5% of the vote in the capital, while out of 101 departments, she carried 30 of them, mostly rural. She secured just one department in 2017. 80% of voters described the presidential campaign as being of poor quality, and few desired a rematch of 2017. Macron's problem is that, once again, he can't claim his win signifies a broad mandate for his proposals. Subtract 39% of the total electorate due to abstention and purposely spoiled ballots, and Macron's 58% of the vote falls to just 35% of the electorate. If we fairly assume that, like in 2017, 43% of his voters only did so to block Le Pen, then just 20% of the total electorate chose Macron for his policies or personality. That's a drop of 4 points from 2017. If Macron continues to rule as if his policies don't need a broad popular mandate, then France's permanent social unrest seems likely to continue. A Le Pen victory would have set off immediate protests, but for now, a calm resignation is reigning. However, few expect the Paris street or the rural roundabout to remain quiet for very long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye. Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to Thee, to be joyful in worshipping Thee, to be desirous of Thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me Thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom Thou wilt.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. We are nearing the end of the blessed month of Ramadan. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said, good deeds are rewarded manifold in the month of Ramadan. God says in Ayah 61 of Surah Mu'minun, that the faithful are those who are zealous in performing good works and take the lead in them. In the first ayahs of Surah Al-Waqi'ah, after describing the great event of the Day of Resurrection, God says that the servants will be three groups. The first group is the people of the right hand, whose file of deeds will be given to their right hand. The second group is the people of the left hand, who will receive their file of deeds with their left hand. And the third group is the foremost ones, who are very near to God. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says that when a faithful decides to do a righteous deed, two devils rush to prevent him. So, he should be quick so that the devils do not overcome him to prevent him from doing the righteous deed. As it has been said several times, the devils are chained in Ramadan. Thus, the faithful should embark on righteous deeds. They should try to compete with each other in doing righteous deeds. The food diet in the blessed month of Ramadan should be arranged in a way that it does not increase our weight. In fact, Ramadan is an appropriate opportunity to reduce weight and bring it to normal state. As the hours of fasting are long, it is necessary to choose foods which are easy and soon to digest. Some of these foodstuffs include dates and tea, light puddings made of rice, milk and honey, soup and so on. In order to prevent reflux of stomach, it is better to have light and low-fat foods. Spicy foods, fizzy drinks, coffee, and similar drinks aggravate the condition. It is highly recommended to have light iftar to avoid overload of stomach. Moreover, eating slowly helps digestion. It takes 15 to 20 minutes for the brain to get the message that the person is full. Slow eating is helpful in this regard. In iftar, it is better to have fresh lemon juice in water rather than dark tea or coffee. Flaxseed juice is also refreshing and helpful. In order to prevent constipation, it is good to eat rinsed plums and figs. Fruits like peach and watermelon are also good, although many of them are not available in this season. Specialists of nutrition say that eating a few dates at iftar is good, especially for those who suffer from headache or vertigo. This is due to the fact that most headaches stem from low blood sugar. Interestingly, our religious leaders have recommended dates more than 1,000 years ago. It is not good to have cooked foods with raw fruits because the time of digestion differs for these items. Raw foods are digested faster, but due to mixing with the cooked ones, they cannot exit the stomach and cause dyspepsia. The blessed month of Ramadan is the time of servitude, worship, and self-purification. True servants of God make maximum use of the moments of this month to gain God-weariness. Ayatollah Khamenei is used to keep vigil in part of the nights of this month. He uses the pre-dawn hours to recite special prayers and supplications, and also the Noble Quran. This has been the practice of great ulema for centuries. They used to perform their daily ritual prayers as soon as the time for each prayer arrived. Ayatollah Khamenei, like his predecessors, particularly his great teacher, Imam Khomeini, spends part of his nights to seek forgiveness of God. He has described Ramadan as part of paradise in the burning hell of the material world. He says, God has given us the opportunity to admit ourselves in paradise in this month at the divine banquet. Some people enter paradise only for those 30 days. Some With the blessing of those 30 days, enter the whole year, some others for the entire life. Still, some others pass by it negligently, which is the cause of sorrow and loss. The leader of the Islamic Revolution says on the value of the moments of Ramadan, we need these hours. Let us make the maximum use of these blessed days and nights through strengthening our heart relation with the spiritual world, the unseen world, through humbleness, appealing and beseeching before the Lord of all Lords, and through reinforcing our bond of velayat with the Ahlul Bayt, this noble family. This is the basis of all good deeds, which can be performed by a faithful and hardworking person in the way of truth. If we do not make use of these hours and this opportunity, one day it will cause regret for us. These opportunities are lost unbelievably in negligence. And on the day when our every hour, every minute, our every move, our every word is reckoned, and there is a calculation, this negligence will cause regret.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
West loves Israel. I am Edward Said. I was born in 1935 into a Christian family in Palestine. I was forced to leave my homeland after the occupation of Palestine. I lived in Egypt and Lebanon for a while and eventually went to the U.S. I studied English literature and became a distinguished professor at one of the most prestigious U.S. universities. But the Six-Day War in 1967 reminded me again that I was the child of an occupied homeland and a fugitive. I asked myself why no one in the U.S. and the West paid attention to this brutal occupation. When I studied Western literature and history with this question in my mind, I realized that the West not only has no problems with Israel, but also loves Israel. My years of research in literary and historical texts led me to a theory that I proposed in Orientalism.
I was struck by the consistency and the coherence of pictures or representations of the East, or the Orient as I called it, in a lot of European culture, you know, say 19th century French paintings by Gérôme, for instance, or novelistic writing, say, in the work of people like Flaubert and Disraeli, say, and sort of scholarly writing by linguists and historians and anthropologists and sociologists. The consistency of the picture that emerged of something called the Orient, and this collective portrait of the Orient grew in the 19th century and became as consistent as it was. And I related it to, and I think this was one of the things that was quite controversial, I related it to European power. I was saying, really, that there is no such thing as the Orient. The Orient is much more complicated, much more varied, much more heterogeneous, and above all, much more detailed than any of these grand generalizations about, well, we know that Orientals tend to think in certain ways. That, for example, one of the things I mentioned in the early part of the book was Lord Cromer, who's saying the Oriental mind is different from ours. It is not capable of grasping Western logic. You know, an Egyptian, for example, cannot walk on the sidewalk, he would say. You know, he has to walk on the stairs. That's a function of the mind. And I was saying, all of that's absolute nonsense. You know, you can't make these generalizations and then pretend that they are factual or scientific generalizations. They are rooted in rule.
The other thing he wanted to show is that those forms of representation of the other, of the East, of the Orient, worked according to a set of oppositions. In every way, they were constructed as the complete opposite of one another, and in every case, the positive aspects were associated with the West, and the negative aspects were associated with the East.
The Orient, the mysterious East, a place of fantasy, imagination, desire. This Orient has been created by the West, by artists, thinkers, dreamers, and adventurers. It gives fantastic expression to some reality that Europeans either wanted to possess or fear. Fabulous names, Harun al-Rashid, Omar Khayyam, Shahrazad. Fabulous places, Samarkand, Arabia Felix, Jerusalem the Golden. The lure of Jerusalem is uniquely powerful. It evokes the idea of the fabulous Orient, but it is also of the deepest significance to Muslims, Jews, and Christians. Usually, the Arab is represented as the other, deviant or excessive, less trustworthy, less human. One important function of these images is, I believe, that they justify the use of Western power to seek control over the East and to possess its riches.
Say, for example, that the great Bar Hebraeus, he speaks of this famous Syriac scholar of the 13th century, he says the great Bar Hebraeus was a genius of no parallel to him, but of course that's because he is the son of a Hebrew, see, which is really a problem, meaning to say that if he were not a son of a Hebrew, if he were a son of an Arab, he would have given him a different status.
Orientalism was translated into 26 languages, sparking debates, and had many supporters and critics. The main reason why colonial effects remain in the colonies is that the eastern countries do not have a proper knowledge of themselves, and everything they know as history are the texts and opinions of Western Orientalists.
You take the modern Arab intellectual now, or the Muslim intellectual in general, when they want to talk about their own history, because they haven't done their homework, at the very end of the day, they go and quote what Grunenbaum had said, what Brockelmann had said, what summarized it for them, and hence they are still interpreting their own history through the eyes and through the visions of the Orientalists of the classical, mainly German.
Though at the time I wrote, for example, The Question of Palestine, there were no histories of Palestine. I mean, I had to reconstruct the history, partly. Well, I had to deconstruct the official history that one saw in the Western press and in Western scholarship.
Said noted that the making of knowledge for the purposes of re-describing or reconfiguring the history of Islamic civilization altogether is a very important subject, because language matters. How you describe your own history matters. And hence these people, these Orientalists, they are configuring for us the history and the intellectual history of Islamic civilization, and hence we are dependent on them.
The Iranian Revolution in 1979 was significant in my view. It was not violent, and a relationship was formed between the people and the religious leaders during the revolution, which, in my opinion, had a new meaning for the West. But the American media showed the Iranian Revolution differently from what it really was, in line with the U.S. government's policies to show a violent image of Islam.
And eventually, the inheritor of Iran.
He defended the Islamic Revolution by talking, by critiquing the American media, how it dealt with it.
Some 60 Americans, including our fellow citizen whom you just saw bound and blindfolded, are now beginning their sixth day of captivity inside the U.S. Embassy in Tehran.
The story of 1979 U.S. Embassy takeover in Tehran mobilized all Americans against Iran. But despite the heavy atmosphere against Iran in the United States, my opinion did not change at all. In my opinion, the story of the embassy was in fact the retaliation of the Iranian people on the U.S. for all the calamities that imperialism and colonialism had inflicted on them. And this had nothing to do with Islam. Although I was a Christian, I could not remain silent in the face of this inverted propagation of Islam. All of these issues led me to write the book Covering Islam in 1981, and in a subheading I wrote, How the Media and the Experts Determine How We See the Rest of the World. The main subject of the book was about the takeover of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. I explained there how the American media, even the biggest and most influential, tried to lead the American public opinion to hate Iranians by big lies.
It seems the Iranian students have the initiative. The next move is evidently up to the United States.
Our destiny was tied to war, and 1982 Lebanon War reminded us of that destiny again.
For years, we had heard it said that we were the ones who were trying to drive the Jews into the sea. And here, before the world's eyes, could be seen the spectacle of Palestinians being sent out into the sea, further away from the land that they came from.
Israel invaded Lebanon. In the years after the Six-Day War, Beirut became a gathering place for Palestinian immigrants and militants, and Palestine Liberation Organization members lived in Beirut too. My family had migrated to a village around Beirut many years ago due to my father's health problems and stayed there. Israel, which considered itself stronger after the Six-Day War, decided to invade Lebanon. I was doing my day-to-day tasks in New York when I suddenly noticed the news of the Israeli attack on television. My old mother was in Beirut, and I was worried.
I mean, the Palestinian presence in Beirut from the early 70s, for about a decade, from the early 70s to the early 80s, was the first time, I would say, in our national existence when we had, in fact, constituted a kind of substitute or ersatz Palestine.
After the occupation of Lebanon, I increased my activities against Israel, having interviews and writing articles. In the same year, I wrote the screenplay for the documentary The Shadow of the West. In this text, I connected my theory with political activities. My main point was the same thing that I wrote in Orientalism, but this time considering Palestine. The main point was how the Orientalist view of the Europeans led them to support the creation of Israel.
Sooner or later, all Arab countries gained independence, all except Palestine. Today, for the Jews who settled in Palestine and founded the State of Israel, the land is theirs.
Zionism is appears to be a movement and an ideology that sort of gathered together the remnants and the kind of remains of a shattered a community of people who had historically been oppressed and abused and discriminated and persecuted in the West, and gathered them together into a very powerful movement, which created a new country. It had all the elements of a kind of phoenix, you know, rising from the ashes. And it also had the appeal of the creation of a new state, which is, I think, very central to the European consciousness. Because, you know, a lot like, for example, the American experiment of Europe, that is to say, sending out people to America to create a new country. And obviously it explains the peculiarly close connection between America and Israel.
But in other times, the power of this idea moved armies and whole nations. Years ago, Christian Europe decided to reclaim the Holy Land, Western Christianity's Holy Land, from the Saracen Muslims. After the Turks were defeated in 1917, the Europeans moved in. Britain and France created a new map dividing this region into protectorates, mandates, and spheres of influence. The names of the officials who first drew that map, Mark Sykes and Georges Picot, still resound throughout the Arab world. It is the map which essentially endures today, with one exception, the country of Palestine. In 1917, Arthur James Balfour stood at the pinnacle of the British imperial establishment. Shortly after Sykes and Picot drew their map, he wrote a letter that was to become famous as the Balfour Declaration. In it, he promised a Jewish homeland in Palestine.
I was blacklisted as an anti-Israel professor because of my type of work. But they were not satisfied with that, and my office was vandalized and set on fire at Columbia University in 1985.
The worst aspect of it is, of course, the occasional threat of violence. I mean, my office has been raided and vandalized. I've received death threats and phone messages that are, you know, quite unpleasant. So there's that. I mean, there's the hint of violence around there.
Well, yeah, I think that was... He lived with it constantly. I mean, one of the interesting things is that he was so powerful a presence that they couldn't really touch him. You know, it's not that they didn't try, constantly tried. When there's so much public relations on one side, you can't avoid public relations if you're going to have any chance at all on the other side. And Edward was a single public relations machine because he was such an appealing person and so knowledgeable and so cultured, and he understood Western culture. He's steeped in it, the music and the literature and so on. And so he couldn't be dismissed.
In 1986, I wrote the book After the Last Sky, and its title was based on the poem of my friend, the famous Palestinian poet, Mahmoud Darwish. The photographs in this book were the work of a Swiss photographer named Jean Moore.
The book was about the real life of the Palestinian people before and after the occupation, a fact that the Western media was afraid to show. The anger of the Palestinian people arose in 1987. An Israeli truck ran over and killed several Palestinian workers, and several similar incidents took place in those days. People stood up against the aggressors empty-handed and with stones. The Intifada had begun and there was a gleam of hope. Certainly, I was a supporter of such an event. I saw such power among the young people who started the Intifada, which showed that no matter how hard they tried to get rid of the name of Palestine, the nation was still alive. The Iraq-Kuwait War in 1990 cost Iraq heavily, and Palestinians suffered as well. The war caused severe divisions in the Arab world. Some Arab government officials were influenced by Saddam's slogans and supported him. Yasser Arafat was one of them. He even visited Saddam shortly after the invasion of Kuwait. It was here that I strongly opposed Arafat. In my opinion, Saddam was just a horrible and a vampire of a dictator. I felt that Arafat was walking on a dark path. Now, Arafat, who was tired and hopeless, had to pay a heavy price for the conflict, and the negotiation table was the best place for the West to take revenge.
In the limelight. In the United States, former President Donald J. Trump was ordered to fully comply with the Attorney General's subpoena and will be fined $10,000 a day until he does, though the new court ruling may be short-lived. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Jonah Bromwich, Ben Protas, and William Rashbaum. The piece is titled, Judge Holds Trump in Contempt Over Documents in New York Attorney General's Inquiry. New York State judge on Monday, 25th of April 2022, held former President Donald Trump in contempt of court for failing to comply with a subpoena from the State Attorney General's office, an extraordinary rebuke of the former president that came as that office suggested it might soon file a long-threatened lawsuit against him. The judge, Arthur Engoron, ordered Donald Trump to fully respond to the subpoena from the Attorney General Letitia James, who sought records from the former president about his family business, and assessed a fine of $10,000 per day until he satisfied the court's requirements. Mr. Trump, I know you take your business seriously, and I take mine seriously, said Justice Arthur Engoron, before he held Donald Trump in contempt and banged his gavel. The contempt order amounted to a judicial condemnation of Donald Trump's signature tactic, stonewalling litigation and law enforcement investigations that he has derided as politically motivated, sometimes for years. That practice has helped him emerge from several inquiries largely unscathed, stymieing a legion of prosecutors, regulators and congressional investigators seeking to hold him to account. But New York Attorney General Letitia James has adopted her own aggressive legal strategy that undercut his long effective approach, and she now appears poised to take the next step. After more than 3 years, Letitia James's office said on Monday, 25th of April, that it was nearing the culmination of its inquiry. During the hearing, a lawyer for Ms. James indicated that her office was preparing to file an action against Donald Trump in the near future. That action is likely to be a lawsuit. Letitia James, a Democrat, has previously said that the Trump Organization engaged in fraudulent or misleading practices, but that she needed to collect additional records and testimony before deciding whether to sue Donald Trump or his company. After Ms. James subpoenaed Donald Trump in December, lawyers for the former president argued that they conducted a thorough search for the records being sought by her investigators and found no new documents to provide. But New York Judge Justice Engoron said on Monday that the lawyers had not provided sufficient detail about how they had conducted the search. The contempt order could be short-lived if Alina Haba, one of Donald Trump's lawyers, files a sworn statement detailing every step that was taken to locate potential documents. The judge might be satisfied, lawyers close to the case have said. Alina Haba said after the hearing ended that she intended to file such a statement. Ms. Haba also said she intended to appeal the ruling. All documents responsive to the subpoena were produced to the Attorney General months ago, Alina Haba said. This does not even come close to meeting the standard on a motion for contempt. Donald Trump has denied wrongdoing and lashed out at Letitia James, who is black, calling her racist and accusing her of carrying out a politically motivated witch hunt against him. At the court hearing, Justice Arthur Engoron objected to an earlier statement from Donald Trump's lawyers regarding their effort to search for documents, calling it woefully insufficient and boilerplate. It failed, he said, to outline what, who, where, when, and how any search was conducted. The court ruling and Justice Engoron's comments represent a significant victory for Letitia James, whose office is conducting a civil investigation into whether Donald Trump falsely inflated the value of his assets in annual financial statements. In a statement, Letitia James applauded the contempt order, saying, "For years, Donald Trump has tried to evade the law and stop our lawful investigation into him and his company's financial dealings." She added, "Today's court ruling makes clear, no one is above the law." Although Letitia James does not have the authority to file criminal charges, her civil inquiry is running parallel to a criminal investigation led by the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, who is examining some of the same conduct. Letitia James's office is participating in that separate investigation as well, which had appeared to be nearing an indictment of Mr. Trump earlier this year, before Alvin Bragg raised concerns about prosecutors' ability to prove their case. Alvin Bragg, also a Democrat, inherited the inquiry from his predecessor after taking office on 1st of January this year. The court ruling on Monday, 25th of April, is a blow for Donald Trump as he continues to battle the Attorney General's investigation. Letitia James has sought to question the former president and two of his children, Ivanka Trump and Donald Trump Jr., as part of her inquiry, and lawyers for the Trump family are seeking to block the questioning. In the autumn of 2020, Letitia James questioned another of Mr. Trump's children, Eric Trump. New York judge Justice Arthur Engoron also ruled in favor of Letitia James as she sought additional documents from Cushman and Wakefield, a real estate firm that valued several of Donald Trump's properties while also serving as a broker for his company. And in March, Justice Engoron ruled in favor of Letitia James, ordering Donald Trump and his children to be deposed. The Trumps have appealed that ruling. New York judge Arthur Engoron, a Democrat, was first elected to the New York City Civil Court in 2003. He was elevated to serve as an acting state Supreme Court justice in 2013 and elected to the state Supreme Court bench in 2015. In New York, the general trial level court is called the Supreme Court. The state's highest court is known as the Court of Appeals. Earlier this month, lawyers from Letitia James's office said that Donald Trump had declined to turn over documents in response to 8 separate requests and called for him to be held in contempt of court and assessed a daily fine of $10,000 as long as he continued not to cooperate. Donald Trump's lawyers have said the requests were grossly overboard and did not adequately describe the requested materials. And Alina Haber said in a document filed with the court last week that Donald Trump did not have any of the documents that Letitia James had requested, and that any such documents, if they existed, would be in